This is Anne reading from the Washington Post on Wednesday, February 15th. DHS spokeswoman, who became a face of Trump deportation campaign, steps down. By David Nakamura, Marianne Levine, and Isaac Arnsdorf. The Department of Homeland Security's top spokesperson is leaving the Trump administration, officials said Tuesday, a departure that comes amid falling public approval ratings for the president's mass deportation agenda. Trisha McLaughlin, whose regular Fox News appearances made her a face of the administration's hardline immigration agenda, is leaving just over a year into Homeland Security Secretary Kristi L. Noem's tenure leading the agency. The move comes after DHS and the White House have scrambled to tamp down public outrage over the killings of two U.S. citizens by federal immigration agents in Minneapolis last month. McLaughlin informed colleagues Tuesday of her departure. She had begun planning to leave in December, but extended her stay to help the administration deal with the fallout of the fatal shootings of Renee Good and Alex Preddy in Minneapolis, according to people briefed on her exit. Politico first reported on McLaughlin's departure. Confirming McLaughlin's decision in a post on X on Tuesday, Noem cited her exceptional dedication, tenacity, and professionalism, and said she has played an instrumental role in advancing our mission to secure the homeland and keep Americans safe. In a statement, McLaughlin thanked Noem and President Donald Trump, saying she is immensely proud of the team we built and the historic accomplishments achieved by this administration and the Department of Homeland Security. McLaughlin said she will be replaced by her deputy, Lauren Biss, and DHS's public affairs team is adding Katie Zakaria, a frequent Fox News guest. Noem's chief spokeswoman built a reputation as a fierce defender of the administration's handling of immigration and of secretary's leadership, frequently sparring with reporters on social media and appearing on cable news programs. But her forceful pronouncements have drawn criticism from Democrats and immigration rights groups, who point to incidents in which statements she made were later contradicted in court or in video footage recorded by witnesses. McLaughlin joined other administration officials in quickly declaring that Good had committed an act of domestic terrorism before she was shot to death by an immigration officer. McLaughlin also said a Venezuelan immigrant had mercilessly beat a federal law enforcement officer in Minneapolis. The charges against that man were dropped after the U.S. attorney in Minneapolis said that newly discovered evidence was materially inconsistent with the allegations the officers had made. In those and other incidents, McLaughlin quickly made statements supporting actions by officers before investigations had transpired, something that Democrats and some Republicans have also criticized Noem for doing. Christopher Parente, an attorney for Miramar Martinez, a U.S. citizen shot multiple times by a Border Patrol agent in Chicago in the fall, asked a federal judge for permission to release body camera footage and other evidence that he said was necessary to demonstrate that McLaughlin and other senior administration officials had falsely accused Martinez of being a domestic terrorist and of doxing federal agents. Martinez was indicted on federal charges of assault and attempted murder of a federal employee with a deadly or dangerous weapon after the shooting. But a federal judge dismissed the case in November after prosecutors in the Northern District of Illinois requested that the charges be dropped. Prosecutors didn't state a reason for the dismissal, although attorneys for the defendant criticized the weakness of the government's case from the start. "We are pleased with this resignation," Parente told the Washington Post when asked about McLaughlin's departure. "Unless Pinocchio is applying for the position, we believe her replacement will be a great improvement and hopefully work to start repairing the credibility of DHS." Under McLaughlin, critics say the DHS Public Affairs Office has produced a skewed view of immigration enforcement. Officials have refused to publish detailed reports of how many immigrants have been arrested and deported. The agency's messaging has mainly publicized the arrests of immigrants who commit crimes, even though public records show that a majority of migrants who have been detained do not have criminal records. McLaughlin also has repeatedly attacked federal judges who have ruled against the administration, calling them unhinged, deranged, and disgusting and immoral. In some cases, she has accused judges of endangering immigration agents or the public through their rulings. David Lappin, a DHS spokesman in Trump's first administration, said he hopes McLaughlin's replacement stays away from the belligerent attacking approach that she took. This mis- and disinformation that comes out hurts the trust and credibility of the organization, and they can't afford to have that continue, Lappin said. But McLaughlin's combative approach won public praise from Trump last month. Great job by wonderful Tricia McLaughlin, DHS Assistant Secretary, on the Sean Hannity show, Trump posted on social media. Many illegals from around our nation charged with serious crimes this week. Tricia really knows her stuff. Democrats have criticized DHS's posts on social media for disparaging immigrants and posting paintings that depict scenes of predominantly white America. One post featured an ICE recruitment promotion that stated, "We'll have our home again," a phrase that has been associated with a song embraced by white nationalists. McLaughlin defended that promotion, telling the Post in a statement last month, "The fact that people would like to cherry-pick something of what white nationalism with the same title to make a connection to DHS law enforcement is disgusting." McLaughlin was still posting on X Tuesday, disputing an NBC News report of growing tensions between DHS leadership and Coast Guard officials over Noem's use of the military branch's resources, which she oversees. The Post has also reported on the strained relationship between DHS and the Coast Guard, including Noem's decision to spend $200 million on new Coast Guard jets for use by senior DHS officials, and her move into military housing typically reserved for the Coast Guard commandant. Before her tenure at DHS, McLaughlin was a senior advisor and communications director for Vivek Ramaswamy's 2024 presidential campaign. She joins other senior DHS officials who have left the department in recent weeks, including Madison Sheehan, who last month stepped down from her role as Immigration and Customs Enforcement's deputy director to mount a campaign against Democratic Representative Marcy Kaptur in Ohio. Epstein files have brought a wave of resignations and investigations by Megan Vasquez and Sammy Westfall. It has been more than 2 weeks since the latest tranche of files related to deceased financier Jeffrey Epstein was released by the Justice Department, outlining years of correspondence and visual evidence connecting the convicted sex offender to some of the wealthiest and most powerful people in the world. The massive trove, totaling more than 3 million documents, has roiled Europe, leading to resignations and criminal inquiries. In the United States, however, professional exits and investigations of the individuals named in the files have not taken place on the same scale. Only a few high-profile people, such as Kathy Ruemmler, an official in the Obama White House, have stepped down from their jobs after new revelations of their connections to Epstein. Epstein pleaded guilty in 2008 to two charges of soliciting prostitution, including one involving a minor. He was arrested on federal sex trafficking charges in 2019 and died in federal custody later that year. His death was ruled a suicide. Judges and lawmakers say that over decades, he abused, trafficked, and molested scores of girls, many of whom have come forward in court and in other public forums. Here is a list of some of the prominent figures who have resigned from their roles or are facing investigations after their communications with Epstein and his former longtime companion, Ghislaine Maxwell, were released last month. Peter Attia, Attia, a physician and longevity expert, faced scrutiny after the latest release of documents revealed his friendly and sometimes crude correspondence with Epstein. In one 2016 message, Attia wrote Epstein, "P is indeed low carb," still adding, "results on gluten content, though." In June 2015, Attia wrote to Epstein, "You know, the biggest problem with becoming friends with you, the life you lead is so outrageous, and yet I can't tell a soul." After the emails became public, Attia stepped down from his role as chief science officer of a protein bar brand, David Protein, according to the company's co-founder. The powdered supplement company, AG1, said in a statement that Dr. Attia is no longer an advisor to the company. Attia apologized for his interactions with Epstein, writing on X that he was never involved in any criminal activity and that his interactions with Epstein had nothing to do with his sexual abuse or exploitation of anyone. Days before the emails were released, CBS News editor-in-chief Barry Weiss announced a new slate of contributors that included Attia. Despite previous reporting by the network's journalists indicating that Attia had ties to Epstein, his appearances in the latest tranche of documents led to further scrutiny about his employment at the network. CBS News did not respond to a request for comment. Sultan Ahmed bin Sulayem. Bin Sulayem, an Emirati businessman, resigned from his role as chairman of DP World, one of the world's largest logistics companies. In a February 13 statement, the company said the resignation was effective immediately. Bin Sulayem appears in wide-ranging exchanges with Epstein telling the Sultan in one 2013 email, "You are one of my most trusted friends in the very sense of the word. You have never let me down." Bin Sulayem replied, "Thank you, my friend. I am off the sample of fresh 100% female Russian at my yacht." The resignation statement does not explicitly mention Bin Sulayem's connection to Epstein, but DP World had faced pressure from financial groups after the emails were released. Sarah Ferguson. Sarah's Trust, the charity founded by Sarah Ferguson, a former Duchess of York, shut down for the foreseeable future following the latest document release. "Our chair, Sarah Ferguson, and the Board of Trustees have agreed that with regret the charity will shortly close for the foreseeable future," the trust said in a statement. "This has been under discussion and in train for some months." Other charities also dropped Ferguson as a patron. Emails released by the Justice Department revealed that Ferguson maintained a contact with Epstein long after his 2008 conviction. Ferguson is the ex-wife of Andrew Mountbatten Windsor, who also had ties to Epstein. More than a decade ago, Ferguson tried to publicly distance herself from Epstein. In a 2011 interview, she said that her closeness to him, which included borrowing £15,000 to pay off debts, was a mistake. "I abhor pedophilia and any sexual abuse of children, and know that this was a gigantic error of judgment on my behalf," she said at the time. Lawrence H. Summers. Larry Summers, a former Harvard University president who served as Treasury Secretary under President Bill Clinton, stepped back late last year from public commitments, including teaching and resigning from the board of OpenAI, the firm behind ChatGPT. This came after Congress released a tranche of documents showing that the two men maintained a close friendship, keeping up months-long email exchanges over several years until the day before Epstein was arrested in 2019. In a November statement, Summers said that he was deeply ashamed of my actions and recognized the pain they have caused, and that his stepping out of the public eye is one part of my broader effort to rebuild trust and repair relationships with the people closest to me. For decades, Summers was an influential figure on economic thought in Washington, holding positions including the World Bank's chief economist and senior roles in the Clinton and Obama administrations. He launched his policy career in Ronald Reagan's White House and advised President Joe Biden, even while being one of Biden administration's harshest Democratic critics on economics. He was also active in the private sector, including joining the board of OpenAI in 2023 and advocating a light regulatory approach to AI. The Washington Post has a content partnership with OpenAI. Thorbjørn Jagland. Jagland, a former Secretary General of the Council of Europe and a former Prime Minister of Norway, was charged with aggravated corruption in connection with his ties to Epstein, said a spokesperson for Eldon Law Firm, which represents Jagland. The charges came after the Council of Europe waived immunity for Jagland at the request of Norwegian police conducting the investigation. Jagland was one of several European officials who had engaged in correspondence with Epstein, the recently released files show. In the 2010s, emails show Epstein repeatedly attempted to arrange a meeting with Russian President Vladimir Putin through Jagland. There is no evidence in the Justice Department files that such a meeting took place. Epstein also asked Jagland to relay a message to the Kremlin suggesting that officials should consult him if they wanted a better understanding of how to engage with Donald Trump, who was then in his first presidential term. A lawyer for Jagland, a former head of the Norwegian Nobel Committee, has said that Jagland will cooperate with the investigation. Mona Juul and Terje Rød Larsen. Juul, a Norwegian diplomat who last week resigned as the country's ambassador to Jordan and Iraq, and her husband, former diplomat Terje Rød Larsen, are facing corruption investigation by police in Norway after media reports indicated that Epstein had left the couple millions in his will. Juul is charged with aggravated corruption, and Rød Larsen is charged with contribution to aggravated corruption. Juul has been clear that she regrets having had contact with Jeffrey Epstein, her attorney said in a statement. The fact that she now acknowledges that she has shown poor judgment by having contact with Epstein does not mean that she has acted in violation of the criminal law. Brad Karp. Karp resigned as longtime chairman of the law firm Paul Weiss, Rifkind, Wharton, and Garrison after a series of emails between him and Epstein became public, outlining his extensive relationship with the financier. The newly released documents include an email exchange from 2015 in which Karp thanked Epstein for hosting him for a once-in-a-lifetime evening. Epstein told Karp that he was always welcome and that there are many, many nights of unique talents. You will be invited often. A statement from the firm did not explicitly mention Karp's connections with Epstein, whom the firm said it never represented. But Karp, in the statement, acknowledged that recent reporting has created a distraction and has placed a focus on me that is not the best interests of the firm. Although he will no longer serve as chairman, Karp will remain at the firm. Miroslav Lajcak. Lajcak, a former president of the UN General Assembly, resigned from his role as national security advisor in Slovakia's prime minister over his communications with Epstein. Documents revealed that in 2018, while Lajcak was serving as Slovakia's foreign minister, Epstein and Lajcak shared jokes about women and discussed an upcoming meeting with Russian Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. In an interview with Radio Slovakia, translated by Politico, Lajcak said, "When I read those messages today, I feel like a fool. It was a private conversation, let's be honest. Who would be happy if the whole nation were reading their messages? At the very least, I exercised poor judgment." He added, "But that does not absolve me of responsibility. I showed poor judgment and inappropriate communications." Lajcak condemned Epstein's crimes and said, "There were no girls. The fact that someone is communicating with a sexual predator does not make him a sexual predator." Jack Lang. Former French Culture Minister Jack Lang and his daughter Caroline Lang are facing an investigation involving laundering of aggravated tax fraud proceeds, French financial crimes prosecutors confirmed to the Washington Post. The inquiry comes in response to an investigation by French independent news outlet Mediapart, which outlined Jack Lang's close ties to Epstein. Jack Lang also resigned from his role leading the Arab World Institute after he was summoned to appear at the French Foreign Ministry, which oversees the institute. The opening of a preliminary investigation by the National Financial Prosecutor's Office is news that I welcome with calmness and even relief. It will shed light on accusations that attack my integrity and my honor. Jack Lang wrote on X, "The accusations against me are baseless, and I will prove this beyond the sound and fury of the media and digital courts." Peter Mandelson. Mandelson, a former British ambassador to the United States, resigned from the Labour Party in early February and subsequently resigned from the House of Lords amid renewed scrutiny of his connection to Epstein. On February 6th, British police searched two properties linked to Mandelson as part of a misconduct investigation stemming from his ties to Epstein. The fallout comes after the Financial Times reported on Justice Department documents that appear to show Epstein made payments totaling about $75,000 to accounts linked to Mandelson when he was a Labour Member of Parliament in the early 2000s. The files include an undated photograph of a man who appears to be Mandelson in a t-shirt and underwear alongside an unidentified woman. In a letter to labor officials, Mandelson insisted that he had no record or recollection of the payments from Epstein and that the allegations need investigating by me. But in addition to stepping down from the party, he wrote, "I want to take this opportunity to repeat my apology to the women and girls whose voices should have been heard long before now." In September, Mandelson was dismissed as Britain's ambassador to Washington by Prime Minister Keir Starmer after communications emerged showing a closer relationship with Epstein than Mandelson had acknowledged. Morgan McSweeney. McSweeney resigned from his role as British Prime Minister Keir Starmer's chief of staff amid mounting criticism over the appointment of Mandelson as British ambassador to the United States in December 2024, despite knowledge that Mandelson had a relationship with Epstein. McSweeney said that when asked, he advised the Prime Minister to make that appointment, and I take full responsibility for that advice. He called the decision wrong and damaging to our party and our country, trust in politics itself, in a public resignation statement. Starmer, who is facing growing calls to resign as prime minister over Mandelson's appointment, has claimed that the former ambassador lied about how close he was to Epstein. George J. Mitchell. Mitchell, a former U.S. senator who represented Maine as a Democrat before serving as President Bill Clinton's envoy to Northern Ireland, is mentioned more than 300 times in the latest Justice Department document drop. Mitchell resigned as the honorary chairman of his namesake institute in early February. The leadership of the institute said in a statement that it agreed that this is an appropriate time to initiate a thoughtful, responsible process to consider potential name change. The U.S.-Ireland Alliance also announced in February that its board of directors had unanimously agreed that its George J. Mitchell Scholarship Program should no longer bear the former secretary's name, saying that the decision was made in response to new information that had come to light in the latest Epstein document release. A spokesperson for Mitchell previously said the senator never suspected or had any knowledge of Epstein's illegal or inappropriate conduct with underage girls. Andrew Mountbatten-Windsor. The new batch of Epstein documents included photographs that appeared to show Mountbatten-Windsor, the younger brother of King Charles III, crouched over a woman on the floor. The documents, which include previously unseen photographs and several email messages, contain no allegations of criminal activity by the former prince, who has long denied any wrongdoing. Mountbatten-Windsor had faced consequences previously regarding his ties to Epstein, having been stripped of his royal title and ordered to vacate the Royal Lodge. He officially moved out of the residence this month And after revelations from the latest batch of files, British Prime Minister Keir Starmer suggested that Mountbatten-Windsor should testify before the U.S. Congress about his links to Epstein. David A. Ross. Ross, an influential figure in the contemporary art world, resigned from his position as the chair of the master's degree program in art practice at the School of Visual Arts in New York following revelations about his friendship with Epstein, first revealed by Art News. Among their email exchanges was a 2009 thread in which Ross appeared to support Epstein when the financier told him he was thinking about funding an art exhibition entitled Statutory that would display images of girls and boys ages 14 to 25 where they look nothing like their true ages. The School of Visual Arts said in a statement to the Post that it was aware of the correspondence between Ross and Epstein and that the college accepted Ross's resignation on February 3rd. Ross told Art News in an email that after learning of Epstein's 2008 jailing in Florida, he believed Epstein's claim that he had been the subject of a political frame-up because of his support of former President Clinton. When the reality of his crimes became clear, I was mortified and remain ashamed that I fell for his lies, he continued, adding that he continues to be appalled by his crimes and remain deeply concerned for its many victims. Kathy Ruemmler. Ruemmler, an Obama White House lawyer, is resigning from her role as the chief legal officer and general counsel of Goldman Sachs following months of reports about her friendly exchanges with Epstein. My responsibility is to put Goldman Sachs' interests first, Ruemmler, who has previously said she regrets ever knowing Epstein, said in a statement released last week. Earlier today, I regretfully informed David Solomon of my intention to step down as chief legal officer and general counsel of Goldman Sachs as of June 30, 2026. In email exchanges with Epstein in September 2014, days before then-Attorney General Eric H. Holder stepped down from his position, Ruemmler appeared to be weighing whether she would replace him at the Justice Department. At the time, she was widely reported to be a contender for the role. The latest document drop also showed that after she left her White House role, Ruemmler received gifts from Epstein, including an Hermes handbag and a spa day at a Four Seasons hotel. Joanna Rubinstein. Rubinstein, the chair of Sweden for UNHCR, a fundraising foundation for the United Nations Refugee Agency, resigned after the recently unsealed documents revealed she visited Epstein on his private island in 2012. Joanna Rubinstein did indeed step down from her role on February 1st following media attention concerning events that took place long before she joined the board of Sweden for UNHCR, and of which the organization had no prior knowledge. Ulrika Bellin, the group's director of communications, wrote in an email to the Post. Rubinstein told Swedish publication Expression that she was aware of the verdict at the time of the visit to Little St. James, referring to Epstein's 2008 conviction. What has subsequently emerged about the extent of the abuse is appalling and something I strongly distance myself from, Rubinstein added. Steve Tisch. The National Football League said that it would review communications between Tisch, who co-owns the New York Giants, and Epstein following the latest document release. We are going to look at all the facts. We are going to look at the context of those. We are going to try to understand that, NFL Commissioner Roger Goodell said at a news conference in San Jose in early February, days before the Super Bowl. Goodell stopped short of saying the league would formally investigate Tisch over the matter. He also said it was premature to evaluate whether Tisch will be disciplined under the league's personal conduct policy. Tisch's name reportedly appeared at least 440 times in the more than 3 million documents. Epstein connected Tisch with numerous women, according to email exchanges first reported by The Athletic. We had a brief association where we exchanged emails about adult women, and in addition, we discussed movies, philanthropy, and investments, Tisch said in a statement last month. I did not take him up on any of his invitations and never went to his island. As we all know now, he was a terrible person and someone I deeply regret associating with. Casey Wasserman. Wasserman is selling his talent agency after the emergence of flirtatious correspondence between himself and Ghislaine Maxwell in the latest batch of files, according to a memo from Wasserman to his agency staff obtained by the Associated Press. The document drop includes an email in which Wasserman expressed a desire to see Maxwell in a tight leather outfit. In late 2021, Maxwell was convicted in federal court for her role in trafficking girls and is serving a 20-year prison sentence. The emails do not directly link Wasserman to Epstein himself and were sent in 2003. The decision from Wasserman, who wrote to staff in the memo that he felt he had become a distraction, came after several entertainers announced their departures from the agency over his appearance in the files. Wasserman expressed his deep regret over the correspondence, which he said took place long before Maxwell's crimes became known. I never had a personal or business relationship with Jeffrey Epstein. As is well documented, I went on a humanitarian trip as part of a delegation with the Clinton Foundation in 2002 on the Epstein plane. I am terribly sorry for having any association with either of them, the statement said. Ahead of Wasserman's role as chairman of the 2028 Los Angeles Summer Games, the executive board of the Olympics issued a statement saying that he will continue to chair the games following a review of his past interactions with Epstein and Maxwell. We found Mr. Wasserman's relationship with Epstein and Maxwell did not go beyond what has already been publicly documented, the statement said. Jesse Jackson, a leading voice for civil rights, dies at 84. By Edward Walsh. The Reverend Jesse Jackson, a charismatic preacher who became the leading voice of Black American aspirations in the years after the assassination of the Reverend Martin Luther King Jr., and was the first African American to gain significant traction as a presidential candidate, died Tuesday. He was 84. His family announced the death in a statement which does not say where or how he died. Reverend Jackson had initially been diagnosed with Parkinson's disease in 2015. Years later, he learned he had progressive supranuclear palsy, a neurological disorder that affects movement. At the height of his influence, Reverend Jackson was widely regarded as the nation's preeminent civil rights leader, a ubiquitous presence before the television cameras. He showed up at protests and marches across the country to champion civil rights and social justice. And when civil disorders broke out, as it did after King's assassination in 1968, and decades later after the fatal police shooting of 18-year-old Michael Brown in Ferguson, Missouri in 2014, he urged restraint and nonviolence. In the late 1970s, he began to expand his activities beyond the United States. He thrust himself into Middle East peacemaking, prisoner release efforts, and the movement against apartheid in South Africa. And he was regularly seen in company of presidents and foreign leaders. He was ordained as a Baptist minister, but never had his own church, preferring the wider stage of civil rights activism. At 6'2", with the power and fluid grace of an athlete, he was a commanding presence wherever he went. As a public speaker, he was electrifying. Reverend Jackson's oratorical style, like the civil rights movement, was rooted in the Black churches of the South. He would begin slowly in an almost conversational tone and gradually build to a crescendo that left some listeners in tears. On Saturday mornings in Chicago, he would lead a crowd of devoted followers in his signature chant, often broadcast live on local and national radio. It began something like this. I am somebody. I may be poor, but I am somebody. I may be on welfare, but I am somebody. I may be uneducated, but I am somebody. I may be in jail, but I am somebody. Reverend Jackson's message to Black Americans was largely one of self-help. Keep hope alive, he would say, or you may be the slum, but the slum doesn't have to be in you, or freedom ain't free. His drive and passion also brought him detractors. At times he annoyed King, and he feuded with other King aides, some of whom considered him a shameless self-promoter. Like many who knew him well, Roger Wilkins found Reverend Jackson both inspiring and exasperating. As an editorial writer for the Washington Post in the 1970s, Wilkins had to deal with Reverend Jackson as a frequent and often uninvited visitor. He would just show up, Wilkins said. It was Reverend Jackson with Dr. So-and-so is downstairs to see you. He wanted his name in the paper. In 1968, Wilkins, as a young African-American official in the Justice Department, walked the streets of Washington amid the rioting that followed King's assassination. He made his way to 14th Street Northwest, where Reverend Jackson was speaking to an angry crowd. It's not black pride to burn down a black man's store, Wilkins recalled Reverend Jackson saying. After a while, the anger subsided and the crowd began to drift away. I saw it with my own eyes, Wilkins said. He really did preach the violence out of those people. Reverend Jackson ventured where no civil rights leader had gone before by seeking the 1984 Democratic presidential nomination. He was widely viewed as a gadfly with no chance of winning. By all accounts, his poorly funded campaign was the most chaotic and disorganized of the modern era. He amassed more than 3 million votes during the primaries, and he took 384 delegates with him to the Democratic National Convention in San Francisco. From an initial field of 8 candidates, he finished 3rd in the primary campaign behind former Vice President Walter F. Mondale, the eventual nominee, and Senator Gary Hart of Colorado. When they write the history of this primary campaign, the longest chapter will be on Jackson, Mario Cuomo, the New York governor, said to the Post at the time. The man didn't have 2 cents. He didn't have one television or radio ad, and look what he did. 4 years later, Reverend Jackson again sought the Democratic nomination. He was better financed and organized, and he easily improved on his 1984 results. He won about 7 million votes, including 12% of white voters. When he won the Michigan caucuses in 1988, he briefly became the leader in the nomination race. He went to the party's national convention in Atlanta with more than 1,200 delegates, second only to the eventual nominee Michael S. Dukakis, the Massachusetts governor. He had gone further than any black person in American presidential politics until that time, a generation before Barack Obama sought and won the White House in November 2008. My race was never about running for the White House alone, Reverend Jackson told journalist Barbara A. Reynolds, author of a Jackson biography. It was about 10,000 people running in their states for school board and sheriff and state legislatures, running for Congress and mayor and governor. Reverend Jackson was among the throng of Obama supporters who participated in the victory celebration in Chicago's Grant Park, and his wellspring of tears was noticed by reporters. He explained the next day to NPR, well, on the one hand, I saw President Barack Obama standing there looking so majestic, and I knew the people in the villages of Kenya and Haiti and mansions and palaces in Europe and China were all watching this young African-American male assume the leadership to take our nation out of a pit to a higher place. And then I thought about who was not there, Medgar Evers, the late husband of Sister Murley. There's Schwerner, Goodman, and Cheney, 2 Jews and a black killed in Philadelphia, Mississippi, and Jimmy Lee Jackson. So the martyrs and the murdered whose blood made last night possible, I could not help but think this was their night. And if I had one wish, if Medgar or if Dr. King could have just been there for a second in time, it would have made my heart rejoice. And so it was kind of the dual thought of his ascendance and leadership and the price that was paid to get him there. Jesse Lewis Burns was born in Greenville, South Carolina on October 8, 1941. His mother, Helen Burns, was a 16-year-old high school student. His father, Noah Robinson, was a cotton grader and respected member of the community. He lived next door and was married to another woman. About 2 years after giving birth, Helen Burns married Charles Jackson, a postal worker who adopted Jesse. At all-black Sterling High School, Jesse Jackson was a good student and an outstanding athlete. He was the starting quarterback, the class president, and the student body president. His athletic ability won him a scholarship to the University of Illinois, but he left after a year in 1960. For years, he maintained that he quit Illinois because the coaches told him that they would not play a black student as quarterback. Years later, reporters discovered that the Illinois quarterback at the time was another African-American, Mel Myers. He transferred to North Carolina Agricultural and Technical College, now North Carolina A&T State University, a historically black institution in Greensboro, where he thrived. He was the starting quarterback on the football team and student body president. The civil rights movement was gaining momentum during Reverend Jackson's college days, and it was then that he had his first experience of social activism, leading student protests in Greensboro. He also met Jacqueline Brown, who he married in 1962. Reverend Jackson graduated in 1964 with a bachelor's degree in sociology and accepted a Rockefeller Foundation grant to attend Chicago Theological Seminary. He did not complete his studies there, leaving after 2 years to devote himself to civil rights work. He was ordained in 1968 by the minister of a Chicago church. Reverend Jackson liked to point out an ironic footnote to his reputation as a compelling orator. At the seminary, his final grade in preaching was a D. The course required that students write their sermons in advance, but Reverend Jackson insisted on simply rising in class and beginning to speak. He's a very brilliant guy, but undisciplined, the Reverend Victor Obenhaus, Reverend Jackson's faculty advisor, later told the New York Times. Like so many in his generation, Reverend Jackson was drawn into the civil rights movement by King. They met in 1965 when Reverend Jackson and other seminary students traveled to Selma, Alabama, for what turned out to be a historic march for voting rights. From the beginning, Reverend Jackson made clear that he did not intend to fade into the crowd. Outside a church in Selma, members of King's Southern Christian Leadership Conference staff were addressing assembled marchers when up popped Jesse, an unknown newcomer, to deliver an impassioned speech, one witness recalled. He immediately took charge. Andrew Young, then a top deputy of King's and later U.S. ambassador to the United Nations and mayor of Atlanta, recalled to the Times, "It was almost like he came in, and while people were lining up, he wouldn't get in line. He would start lining people up." The aggressive young man impressed King, who accepted Reverend Jackson's offer to work as an SCLC organizer in Chicago. Within months, King named him National Director of Operation Breadbasket, an SCLC campaign that pressured businesses to hire and promote black workers. Reverend Jackson's assertiveness soon created tension with other senior King aides. King, too, eventually became exasperated with the brash young activist once telling him, "If you want to carve out your own niche in society, go ahead, but for God's sake, don't bother me." On April 4th, 1968, King was shot by a sniper as he stood on the balcony of the Lorraine Motel in Memphis. Reverend Jackson was in the motel courtyard at the time. His actions over the next several hours drove a deeper wedge between him and other King aides, but also served to propel him toward national prominence. Reverend Jackson immediately returned to Chicago, dressed in the blood-stained turtleneck shirt he had worn in Memphis. He arranged to be interviewed on local television programs and NBC's Today Show, telling reporters that King died in his arms. Reverend Jackson's conduct and his account of King's last moments infuriated the other aides, who vehemently denied his version of the events. Reverend Jackson always defended his actions, which, whatever his intentions, elevated his public profile. In April 1970, Time magazine put an image of Reverend Jackson on the cover of a special issue on Black America. There was tension between Reverend Jackson and Reverend Ralph Abernathy, King's successor as head of the SCLC, and eventually a complete rupture in their relationship. In 1971, the SCLC board suspended Reverend Jackson for 60 days for administrative impropriety after he organized trade fairs for black businesses in Chicago without consulting the SCLC's national leadership. Reverend Jackson resigned from the SCLC in December 1971, announced the formation of a new civil rights organization, Operation Push. Initially, People United to Save Humanity, later renamed People United to Serve Humanity. Operation Push and Push Excel, an affiliate that sought to help black students in inner city schools, became the main vehicle by which Reverend Jackson carried his message to the country. He traveled tirelessly to city schools around the country, exhorting disadvantaged students to do their homework, avoid drugs, and work hard. But the Push Excel campaign to lift struggling urban schools in the late 1970s, like many similar efforts over the years, was beset by administrative woes and forces beyond its control, such as school district budget cuts. For his part, Mr. Jackson may have depended too much on his inspirational powers to drive strong results. I assumed that if we could provide the motivation to get kids into the schools and ready to work, then the schools would take over from there, he told The Times in 1981. He said he saw his role as fostering self-discipline and ambition by holding student rallies with mottos such as "Down with Dope, Up with Hope." I learned that it's not that simple, he said. Reverend Jackson added, I'm not an educator. I'm a preacher. I keep coming back to the parable of the sower. Some of the seeds fell on the stony ground, and some among thorns, and some fell on the good soil and germinated. But even when the seed takes root, you got to wait. Meanwhile, Operation Push won concession from Coca-Cola and other companies that it threatened with boycotts unless they agreed to hire more African-Americans and do more business with black-owned vendors. But critics said that Push's boycott threats differed little from extortion and that some of the black business people who benefited from the Push campaign were major donors to Reverend Jackson's causes. Some business executives, white and black, praised Reverend Jackson's conduct in their negotiations with him. Others said they felt like victims of unseemly tactics. It's a shakedown, T.J. Rogers, then president and chief executive of Cypress Semiconductors in San Jose, told the Los Angeles Times in 2001. The basic shakedown mechanism is he declares racism based on dubious statistics. Then he gives you a chance to repent, and the basic way is to give Jesse money. The threat is you'll be labeled a racist if you don't. That scares business leaders. In 1990, Post columnist William Raspberry wrote critically of Operation Push's call for national boycott of athletic wear giant Nike unless the company did more to advance the economic interests of African Americans. Push contended that Nike should be promoting more African Americans to its executive ranks and doing more business with black-owned companies. It also assailed Nike for running ads that induced poor black youths to pay exorbitant prices for sneakers endorsed by basketball star Michael Jordan. Like so many of the affirmative action proposals, it amounts to bait-and-switch game, Raspberry wrote. The inner city poor furnished the statistical base for the proposals, but the benefits go primarily to the already well-off. What does it do for the poor for Nike to hire an upper-middle-class black executive from another company to be vice president at Nike or to give civil rights leader and business executive Vernon Jordan another seat on a corporate board? Over a dozen years, Mr. Jackson's organizations received about $17 million in government grants and private donations. Audits and other evaluations of the programs found that they were often in chaos with poor management, little follow-through, and weak financial controls. One reason for the dysfunction, according to the people who worked closely with Reverend Jackson, was that he prized loyalty above all else, including competence. Loyalty, absolute loyalty, was always the most important thing to him. Not whether you could do the job, a former Push official told the Los Angeles Times in 1987. The problem with Jackson's program was his inability to sustain its momentum when he was not present. its dependence on his charisma. Joseph A. Califano, Jr., Secretary of Health, Education, and Welfare under President Jimmy Carter, wrote in his 1981 book, Governing America. Reverend Jackson shrugged off such criticism. "I'm a tree shaker, not a jam maker," he would say. Personal charisma was the foundation of Reverend Jackson's public life. Over the years, he expanded his mission into some of the world's most volatile regions. In early 1984, as he began his first presidential run, he traveled to Damascus, Syria, and achieved what American diplomacy had failed to do. He gained the release of Lieutenant Robert O. Goodman, Jr., a Navy aviator who was shot down over Lebanon and taken prisoner by Syrian forces. Other successes followed. Later in 1984, Reverend Jackson visited Cuba, where Fidel Castro released 23 American and Cuban prisoners. During the Persian Gulf War buildup in 1990, Reverend Jackson traveled to Iraq and played a role in persuading Saddam Hussein to release dozens of British and U.S. nationals. In 1979, at the invitation of South African church groups, Reverend Jackson made a high-profile visit to that country. Then, under apartheid, in a stop at a squatter camp, he led thousands of the country's most disadvantaged in his chant of black consciousness and pride. "I may be poor, but I am somebody." 6 years later, he was among the anti-apartheid demonstrators arrested at the South African embassy in Washington, and he continued to push for U.S. corporate and college disinvestment while the racist regime remained in power. "Every investment in South Africa is another brick in the fortress wall that protects that system," he told the New York Times. "The universities have substantial investments there, but more significant, they lend credibility to the apartheid system with those investments." In 1999, he went to Belgrade, Serbia, and negotiated the release of three captured U.S. soldiers who were reported to have served with the U.N. peacekeeping unit and NATO forces during the conflict in Kosovo. Reverend Jackson's international forays were often controversial, especially when they involved the Middle East. He visited the region in 1979 and was photographed embracing Yasser Arafat, head of the Palestinian Liberation Organization. It was later disclosed that between 1978 and 1981, Push affiliates received $200,000 in donations from the Arab League, a confederation of Arab countries, and the PLO. Then, early in the 1984 campaign, Post journalist Milton Coleman reported that in a conversation with him, Reverend Jackson had referred to Jews as Haimies and to New York City as Haimie Town. Reverend Jackson had enjoyed good relations with the Jewish community in Chicago, but the episode caused an uproar, especially among Jewish voters. Reverend Jackson compounded the controversy by at first denying that he had made the remark and suggesting that he was the victim of a conspiracy. He was also slow to disavow the support of Nation of Islam leader Louis Farrakhan, who had a history of making anti-Semitic remarks. Reverend Jackson eventually apologized for the Haimie remark and intensified efforts to reach out to Jewish voters. But he did not change his views on the Middle East, consistently expressing sympathy for Palestinian rights. Reverend Jackson was the first major candidate for U.S. president to advocate the creation of a Palestinian homeland, a position that became official U.S. policy but was widely considered politically unacceptable at the time. To the relief of Democratic Party officials, Reverend Jackson, after his improved performance in 1988, did not seek the party's presidential nomination in 1992. But his civil rights and political activism did not diminish. He traveled incessantly and regularly pushed himself through 18- and 20-hour workdays. In 1997, Reverend Jackson's Rainbow/Push Coalition, formed by the merger of Operation Push and the National Rainbow Coalition, which he founded in the 1980s, started the Wall Street Project. It was modeled on his earlier efforts to win economic benefits for African Americans and other minorities, and it targeted major corporations whose hiring and other business practices Reverend Jackson described as objectionable. Financially, it was far more successful than Operation Push, reporting millions of dollars in contributions to various Rainbow Push Coalition affiliates and giving Reverend Jackson access to the highest levels of corporate America. Reverend Jackson also remained an important figure within the Democratic Party. His registration drives added millions of mostly Democratic voters to the rolls. He was a close ally of President Bill Clinton and one of his spiritual counselors during the impeachment process after the Clinton-Monica Lewinsky scandal. Reverend Jackson campaigned hard for Democratic presidential nominees, Vice President Al Gore in 2000, Senator John F. Kerry in 2004, and Obama in 2008. Jesse mobilized a lot of African Americans, said David Bositis, a former political analyst with the Washington-based Joint Center for Political and Economic Studies and an expert in black voting. When the Democrats took back the Senate in 1986, it was a direct function of what Jesse had started in 1984. It was a trend that was already underway, but he greatly accelerated black participation in the Democratic Party. But Reverend Jackson was never without critics among African-American leaders. One who emerged relatively late in his life was Al Sharpton, the flamboyant New York preacher and one-time protege of Reverend Jackson's, who learned the art of attracting and using media attention from his mentor. Sharpton clearly aspired to replace Reverend Jackson in the hierarchy of black leaders. As Sharpton was maneuvering, Reverend Jackson endured his most serious personal crisis. In 2001, the National Enquirer reported that Reverend Jackson had fathered a girl, Ashley Jackson, with Karen L. Stanford, a former executive director of a Rainbow Push affiliate in Washington. Reverend Jackson apologized to his family and followers. I love this child very much and have assumed responsibility for her emotional and financial support since she was born, he said in a statement. I fully accept responsibility, and I am truly sorry for my actions. Reverend Jackson briefly lowered his public profile, but was soon back, leading his various endeavors, and neither Sharpton nor the other rivals of the post-King era matched his prominence or influence. Although immersed in Democratic politics, Reverend Jackson held only one elective office, a ceremonial one. He maintained a home in Washington and in 1990 was elected the District of Columbia's shadow senator, a position created to lobby Congress for statehood. Representative Reverend Jackson called it a moral crusade. He served one term and did not seek re-election in 1996. That's all the time we have for today. This is Anne saying goodbye, and I'll talk with you again soon.